Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Well, I'm excited today to have Corrine Bell on One Broken Mom. She's actually a somatic experience teacher and also a podcaster with a show called Bold as Love. And what's really amazing about this is that she's an American located in Switzerland. So we are doing an international interview at this moment and connecting with each other, which I'm sorry I sound old sometimes, but I'm blown away by the technology that allows us to link, you know, so many cool minds and people together and not even, I mean, it's like we're sitting in the same room right now, which is just outstanding. She works in a field that drew my attention in about the last 18 months because some people may or may not know this. In 2013, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder called rheumatoid arthritis. And I know one of the things that I've experienced since that diagnosis is a lot of people assume that all arthritis is arthritis and that it's the same. And they don't understand that RA is actually an extremely rare condition that is was always confusing for me with the diagnosis because I always regarded myself as a very healthy person and didn't seem to get sick a lot. And so to be told that you have this extremely rare disease with no known origin for it or cause or genetic, you know, predisposition to it, it piqued my curiosity in trying to understand it. Rheumatoid arthritis actually affects less than 0.1% of the population. So that means in the United States, of the 300 plus million women and men we have here, only 3 million people actually have an actual diagnosis of RA. And what's further astonishing about this particular condition is that 2/3 of the 0.1% of the population are actually women. And further, most of those symptoms crop up in women when they are in their 30s and 40s. So there's a very interesting element to the disease that was like, well, then always had me asking, why me? And I've said this before, not in a weepy sort of victim way, but in this, you know, intrigued research science mind way of, I don't understand this. This is not a normal thing, and I need to know more about this. During the 5 years that I've been living with the diagnosis, I started to see and link my flare-ups with stressful conditions. If something was happening that was causing me anxiety or any other kind of emotional stressor, such as something going on in my personal relationship, my personal romantic relationship, and with work, my body's immune system would start attacking my small joints and causing pain and inflammation, and it would be visible. You could see redness and swelling, and I couldn't move my shoulders and my hands. And this attack wasn't in my head. Blood tests were proving that the immune system was actually attacking the body. My body was responding to my emotions. And so Corrine is one of the many people who I'll be talking with on One Broken Mom that is going to hopefully teach many of us things that we didn't know about the impact of traumatic events, particularly in our childhoods, and how they have been, in fact, correlated to particular physical ailments and diseases. And so while today Corrine is going to talk about some of the therapies that are available and what she does in working with people that have a physical ailment related to some traumatic experiences, later today, actually, which will be released a couple weeks after this one, I'm going to actually be talking with the woman who's been compiling the research worldwide that has been linking adverse childhood experiences with autoimmune disorders like rheumatoid arthritis. And so, Corrine, you're actually kicking off my very first episode with the link of traumatic experiences to the physical body. And so, welcome to One Broken Mom.
Thank you. Thank you, Emmy. Thank you very much for having me.
So let's do some definition for people that are listening here. We've heard the term psychosomatic and it's all in your head and those kinds of things. Help us understand, what is the somatic experience therapy and its origins?
So somatic experiencing is a trauma healing modality that was developed by Dr. Peter Levine over the past several decades. It's actually a modality that's being taught now around the world. There are many, many somatic experiencing practitioners. And the fundamental idea behind somatic experiencing is that our bodies have a way of remembering the traumatic experiences that we've had. We have these different layers of memory, explicit memory, implicit memory, and that a lot of our experiences, they become encoded in our bodies, and they become encoded and they become encoded and become expressed through our stress responses that we have in the body. And somatic experiencing works with the innate healing capacities of the body. The idea behind it being that when we're given enough time and space to allow the body to reorganize itself, that the body's own innate healing capacity will come to the fore, and that we actually innately know how to heal. You know, a big part of the reason why a lot of us don't heal and we go on to experience trauma, and that trauma is often then compounded by the way we live, our environment, and all of this, is because we haven't been able to process and fully metabolize some of those early experiences. That's essentially the somatic experiencing modality. That's the idea behind it. The introduction of time and space is really the first intervention that we bring to the healing dynamic.
Interesting. I actually just finished up, and I'm sorry it took me this long to read it, but Alice Miller's book, The Body Never Lies. And I mean, she moved to the top of my list of, you know, if you could interview anybody in history, who would it be? And she's number one right now. Like, she's planted Thomas Jefferson. But one of the things that she really talks about, and she pulled no punches in that book, talking about the fact that believing and disregarding, how we really feel emotionally, particularly around the treatment we received at the hands of our parents, whether it was mom and dad or one or the other or whatever, is, in her opinion, that repression of those, of really denying that feeling, is where the body stores all that unprocessed emotion. And that sometimes in therapies, we are trying to forgive and forget, but that's actually working against the way our body really, really does feel about it. Do you find that that's a kind of a similar thing in your experience, in your practice?
Well, yes. I mean, the first thing I want to speak to is this really complex dynamic you just spoke about in a child's experience. And that there's a physician named Gabor Mate who also talks a lot about the effects of trauma. He has a really incredible book that if you haven't read, I would recommend to any reader who's interested in the effects on the body of early traumas. It's called When the Body Says No. Mm-hmm. But a quote that he has goes, attachment trumps authenticity. And this speaks to a child's need for the attachment relationship with their mom, their dad, in the earlier part of life. So this is where a really complex dynamic gets introduced, because what will happen is that we are human animals. We are very much an animal. We have an animal's physiology, meaning that when we're in relationship to our environment and to other people, when we experience something that is threatening, it launches a stress response in us. It launches a fight or flight response in us. However, because the attachment relationship is so primary, it's so fundamentally important to us as a child, we will often prize that attachment relationship over our own body's ability to be in touch with and express those responses to our environment. Meaning, if my mother is critical of me and it causes me to feel this anger that, you know, she's, you know, chronically critical, maybe verbally abusive, and it causes me to feel this anger, which is the expression of a healthy aggression, right? Mm-hmm. That healthy aggression is the expression of a boundary. But I know based on my interactions with her that every time I go to express that healthy boundary, it's met with more aggression or it threatens that attachment relationship. Guess what I learned to do? Mm-hmm. I learned to shut that down. I learned to freeze often. You know, if we can't go to fight or flight, guess what we go to? We go to freeze. A lot of the problems that we see in adults is that they have suppressed or have thwarted stress responses. It's kind of stuck in a way in their bodies that have not been allowed to be moved through and expressed in healthy ways. Mm-hmm. And this is a lot where a lot of the patterns that we see in our reactivity come in. And this is where a lot of the chronic inflammation that we see in the body that lasts into adulthood, this is where it's coming from in a large part.
Yeah. Sometimes, and I guess, you know, I know my opinion on this and, you know, like, unlike you, I'm not a therapist. I'm an integrator. I'm bringing people together and talking and asking the questions that my friends and other people would ask if they could sit down with somebody that's an expert in the field. And I know that having had an autoimmune disorder, you get well-meaning advice from people that are like, and part of it is, well, just think more positively about life and it'll all go away. And it's like, I understand where you're thinking about this. Like, yes, I agree that there's stress relationships to my inflammation, and my flare-ups and things like that. Mm-hmm. And managing that is one thing. But I, you know, there's a dual nature in therapies between forgiving and forgetting, you know, which some people may regard as more repression. And then like you use the word authenticity, owning it, putting all the words that it deserves around it, as ugly as they may seem, challenging your experience, and then going forward, you know, with that kind of mode. And those two things aren't the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm saying forgive and forget. Like, we're just going to think more positively about life.
Well, this is what's so interesting to me about that. I mean, this is a big challenge, I think, for people, is that you're absolutely right. I think we either jump too quickly into forgive and forget, or one of the problems that I see is that we need to be able to get in touch with those initial stress responses. And part of that, for especially for women, it's around anger and being in touch with the healthy aggression that lies beyond the anger that is going to be really vital in their healing and in their ability to reclaim their vitality and their ability to set healthy boundaries and say no, right? Mm-hmm. This is a really important thing. But there's a problem in we get into trouble when we start to get in touch with that anger and it automatically goes into and somebody else is responsible for it. What we're actually learning to do in somatic experiencing is not to be in touch with the anger and then somehow make it everyone's fault and, you know, this situation's problem. What we're learning to do is feel our feelings. We're learning to actually give the space for the expression of those feelings without the need to externalize them in some way. And through doing that, that's where we find the sort of the transmutation of those experiences into a healthy vitality and a healthy aggression that actually can be creative and productive in the world. Do you see the difference there though? You know, I think a lot of times we start discussions of getting in touch with anger is about either forgiving a person or internalizing it completely and like suppressing it. And there's a middle road there that we can actually walk where we're both in touch with the emotion or in touch with the underlying stress response, and we're also able to contain it in a sense and allow it to inform, you know, more wise ways of responding to the world and to the people in our lives. That's the difference.
Yeah. I noticed that once I started linking stress to flare-ups, what it did was it made me examine my world and what was going on. And then of course, you know, being able to take that into therapy and discussing, you know, hey, I did this, this, and this, and this happened to me, and I was feeling this way, or pain goes away, or it comes in. But it definitely, you begin to say, well, now I can start to manage, and now it's important to manage my emotions, and it's important to understand the origin of those emotions. Why is this, you know, feeling anxiety, depression, sadness, and how do I need to understand what that cause is? Because once I do that, guess what? The pain goes away. And that's been a powerful piece for me. And that's why part of this is talking with folks like you is because I don't think that a lot of people, we have a society and a culture that hasn't quite linked the fact that some of our physical diseases and ailments are actually not because we don't think happy thoughts every day, but because we have unresolved traumatic issues that happen to us. And one of the things that I try to do too is help define trauma. And I keep repeating it over and over again in all these episodes because a lot of people think trauma has to only be sexual abuse or physical beatings or the extreme cases. But I saw a very simple definition, which I loved, which was that it's really an overwhelming of the neuro system. It's too much too soon for whatever reason. And it doesn't matter what the child is or what the abuse is. If the brain is not ready for it in whatever capacity, that's a traumatic experience for a child, right? So, you know, and so how often are you treating people that aren't actually sexual abuse survivors or physical abuse survivors?
I would say more times than not, really. You know, honestly, I grew up, I have quite an extensive abuse history myself. So really overt trauma, the things that we would identify as traumas. And I remember as I was growing up, what I found really interesting was the fact that I would assume that a lot of my own insecurities or my own struggles had to do with those abuse dynamics that I experienced as kids, only to find that a lot of the people I would talk to had the same experiences I had, or many of similar kind of insecurities and self-doubt and, you know, ongoing maybe physical symptoms as well. And yet they did not have the trauma history that I had. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, this is so interesting and really strange. Like, what's going on there, you know? And that was actually something that made me want to look at how we're living as human beings. It got me interested in the anthropology, the cultural and the historical intersection of how we live in as human beings in social groups in the cultures that we live in, because there's a lot that we can find there about trauma. You know, if you look at the history of parenting, for example, I think it was in the 1950s or something I was reading, it was a manual on how to interact with your kids. And one of the things that it said was, right, don't touch your kids too much. You know, like, they're upset, you know, pat them. I mean, literally, this was written in a book that was circulated to, you know, people, human people.
Yeah.
who are involved in parenting. And this is not a blame thing, but it's an interesting bit of information. Like you, I'm interested in information that can help me understand and sort of put, it's like we're working on putting a big 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle together. Mm-hmm. And trying to understand how all these different elements fit into this bigger picture that is how we experience ourselves as human beings. And I just thought, well, there's something there. There's something culturally, you know, culture in the culture itself that speaks to this experience that many kids have of something being too much, too soon, and too fast to integrate into our experience. And I think one of the biggest things, I mean, there are the overt traumas, but listen, when you're dealing with a parent with depression, for example, we know that children of depressed parents have an inability to know their own impulse responses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things a parent does is they help guide a child, you know, in their impulses to know what's safe and what's not safe. So the child of a depressed parent, for example, might not be able to tell what's safe and not safe because their parent was non-responsive mm-hmm. in many ways. You know, the depressed parent can't be as responsive as they might need to be. So we're, you know, if you're dealing with a parent with a mental health diagnosis, this is, as you know from the ACEs study, one of the factors that contributes to childhood trauma. It's not a direct necessarily or something overt that other people might be able to see and identify, but there are ways that the parent is responding to the child or not responding that really thwarts the child's ability to develop and to process their own distressing experiences in a healthy way.
Right. And to understand, and when I've talked with this with other folks as well, so, you know, an explanation for like the listeners is we learn appropriate emotional responses by the reactions that we get. And so when you are not being seen, and I, you know, we talk about not being seen or witnessed is a way of describing it. But, you know, depression is one piece. When you're behaving in a certain way and your mom is only in one mode, when you're giving signals out of should I be happy, should I be sad, what should I do, and the answer is always the same blank look on the face or ignored. Mm-hmm. What is happening in the brain is that you aren't learning the right signal, or you're learning and your brain just can't process it. And that's how kids and how we have all developed our brains and our understanding of that we carry through life. One of the other traumas too, maybe, I guess is, you know, parents getting divorced, which is pretty commonplace. And our parents have their own stresses that they're going through. They're managing grief of a lost relationship. And we haven't always understood what are boundaries of sharing that grief with our kids or subjecting them to too much of the stress. And I've talked with other people, like, you know, we tend to overshare or completely lock them out. But again, we're denying, you know, teaching them like some appropriate signals for the brain to learn, you know. So you talked and touched a little bit on this. What drew you into this field in particular? So many people go into a variety of different, you know, ways of being able to help and help other people. What was it about this field and a little bit of your story here?
I think ultimately what was really interesting to me about somatic experiencing, I have been in the mindfulness world for a very long time. And I think what intrigued me about mindfulness was really this ability to come to get to know my own experience in a way that allowed me to start to have some authority over how I experience my life. I think one of the effects of trauma is that we're not able to really fully individuate. You know, we're not really fully able to grow up in a sense. We're often really locked. We have these sort of disintegrated parts of ourselves that are trapped in these past trauma experiences. And I really saw mindfulness, the cultivation of awareness, as one way of being able to, well, it wasn't so conscious, I think, when I started, but I came to see it as a way of integrating really all of these disparate aspects of my experience to become whole again. You know, what I recognized, however, when I started to do the practices was the fact that, you know, trauma, when it's been locked in the body, when it emerges, when it's given the space to emerge again, it can sometimes be really scary. Mm-hmm. We don't know always what's going on, you know, and we can actually learn to be scared of our own sensations, right? Or our own, you know, the processes that our body goes through in the natural cycle of a stress response. And so it became pretty clear to me when I was in meditation and I was going on retreats and things like that, that I needed to find another way to be able to work with whatever was happening because there was no language for it. And I think a lot of the people who were, you know, helping people cultivate meditation and mindfulness were not trauma informed. So they didn't know how to guide people actually through the process of working with trauma. So it's not about jumping into the deep end always. It's also about titration and pendulation. We're touching in, we're doing this kind of dance with it. And we're really, in a sense, learning to establish a relationship of trust again between ourselves and how we relate to ourselves. That was a really profound thing to me. So somatic experiencing really, it intrigued me on two levels. On one level, it was this idea of learning in a really profound way how to come back into relationship with the body and also to work with the body's own innate healing capacities, right? Mm-hmm. This was beautiful to me. And also the idea that we are fundamentally, physiologically speaking, animals. And I love the idea of being able to trust that again. That means that we can embrace the range that an animal experiences. I mean, as a human animal, we have a fuller range, but we can learn to embrace the range of our human experience. That means not denying the anger or the aggression, right? It means not just not denying the sadness, but, you know, coming to understand how the grief that we experience has a profound physiologically calming effect on our bodies. It's part of the stress response cycle of activation and deactivation. I think having that even deeper understanding for me was really important in the work that I do, because I'm very much about not looking at the things that we experience as something wrong with us, mm-hmm. but really as just part of a product of, you know, of certain conditions in which we grew up and experienced our lives. And that was really important to me. So that really drew me to the work.
Yeah. And that's, that is profound and pleasant. To sit there and connect back in and be liberated, you know, and being able to, because I think people are taught to thwart their emotions, you know, to, like Absolutely. You said, fear is a great word for it. And the fear may not be that we've learned to be afraid because someone in front of us didn't know how to handle it. And so that response they gave us was their fear response. Like, I don't know what Absolutely. To say to you because I've been denied my own ability to be able to express myself, whether it was intentional or it was circumstantial. You know, one of the parents or the types of broken moms that we talk about on the show is the emotionally immature mom, where yes. just because, again, not getting the right relationship building in terms of understanding their own emotions, those were denied to them and it goes back and back. You know, one of the things you talk about on your site and with the practice and a lot of us that are in this, you know, kind of in the realm now of this trauma healing is there is a generational impact to this, that we are going to continue to pass these down without developing this, you know, self-awareness and mindfulness. When working in the somatic therapeutic experience, who benefits the most from this type of a therapeutic modality?
Well, you know, I think that I think everyone fundamentally can benefit from this.
Yeah.
In terms of really coming to intimately know ourselves and our embodied experience in ways we were never taught culturally. That's a cultural thing. We are not taught to be embodied, right? I think we talked about this before. We're very sort of heady people. We tend to be very cognitive and very analytical. And we become very easily disconnected from the embodied experience. But I do think that, you know, I work with parents, I work with mothers, and I am really interested in this piece of helping mothers to become more embodied and to come to recognize their own traumas and how to work with their own traumas so that they don't pass them on to their children. So in that dynamic, it's both the mothers profoundly benefit from that experience. Especially, I would say, it can be very beneficial for people who have unexplained symptoms, maybe physical symptoms, unexplained or chronic emotional reactivity patterns or habits that they don't know where they come from necessarily, and they feel out of control to change them. Those are often really good indicators that there's been some early trauma, maybe that even lives in the implicit memory, that lives in the somatic narrative, and is not even necessarily tangible or accessible to them by memory, by explicit memory. Those are people who really often highly benefit from something like somatic experiencing, to be able to work with things other than the cognitive narrative, what we can actually verbally communicate, which only is one part of the story, right? Mm-hmm. That's one part and only one version of a much more comprehensive and complex story.
Yeah. I have found through the last, you know, year plus of, you know, my own personal journey through trauma and in going back into it, one aspect of it was having a therapist, an enlightened witness in front of me to be able to say, you know, some of what you're dealing with and your responses, as heightened as they are symptomatic of post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
And then going through the journey of identifying the origin of that piece. And then once you go back to the beginning and going, holy shit, like now all of it makes sense. Like then everything, every step after that has a connection back and all the way up to the present, you know, future in there. One of the things that I think that inhibits people, this is my opinion, but I believe it's informed, is that when you start to talk about childhood trauma, not only do people deny that maybe it ever happened to them, but they also feel guilt and shame of pointing fingers at parents that they believe really loved them, acted in their best interest, maybe made a few mistakes, mm-hmm. and they don't want to dig into that because they don't want to ostracize themselves from their family. They don't want to hurt anybody else's feelings. And I believe that in many times it's a barrier for a lot of people moving forward. And
definitely.
And so, you know, I know for me, it's about recognizing that it happened, but doing it, we're not trying to, you know, come out with machetes and pitchforks and attack our parents, but it is a very big piece of kind of getting to it, of like recognizing that some things happened and parents made mistakes and we don't yes. recognize that. Right. So does
it so, yeah, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No. I'm just going to say, so please talk about that piece of it. Like, I know you've got that experience with working with that kind of stuff. And I just want people to understand that, you know, we can travel back in time and we can address childhood traumas and we can find the mistakes that were made and do it with a way of without attacking everybody around us, even if they might feel attacked. It's necessary for us, right?
I totally agree, Amit, really. And I actually think that we can do it with a lot of compassion. I think it's the thing that we do that actually can engender a profound experience of compassion, not overriding the anger or the aggression that we might feel as well as we're traveling down that road. But really, I think for me, what we're ultimately doing is we are learning to really see the depth of our humanity. We do this with ourselves, and as we do this with ourselves, we see the complexity, we see the layering, we see the contributions of the past on our present, and that is profoundly it can expand our sense of self and really anchor us as human beings in our own humanity. And once we do that, this is an experience that can then get projected into the past and into the future. We can start to see people in all their full humanity. You know, I look at my mom's own life. I had a very difficult, very traumatic dynamic with her in many ways. But one of the things that when I look back now from a more healed perspective, I learned to see both the influence on her life. So like I said, the early environment of her culture, her family life, what was allowed, what was disallowed for her in terms of what she could express, you know, things that could be said, things that couldn't be said. You can actually start to see how all of these early experiences impact a human being's life. And I think that ability to humanize our parents, I think what you're speaking to is, I think it's known as idealization, and it's a strategy that kids employ. It's actually a strategy to maintain our attachment relationships. We have to be able to see our parents, even if we feel in our bodies that's not true. We often idealize them. We make them perfect. Maybe they're wonderful, or they did their best. You know, what can we ask for? And it is a sort of a bypassing. I don't want to see the other stuff because it threatens my attachment to them, like you said, and it's really a strategy. And I think seeing that can really help, and seeing that is also important because oftentimes if we have difficult dynamics and we did have idealization as a strategy, if it's not about them, then it must be about us, right?
Yeah.
So we internalize it as self-blame. It becomes about something that we did or didn't do or should do better, and this chronic self-blaming, self-criticizing, negative self-talk, that's a very common experience for a lot of people who have experienced those kinds of difficult dynamics in their early lives.
Yeah. And I think the other piece of this that, you know, I want to always bring an awareness and enlightenment to folks listening and following is that we have now been able to get past the theory of what we think is going on in our brain to actually now, just in the last, and I've said this before on other shows, and literally in the last 20 years, the neuroscience through the MRIs, the CAT scans, the software processing, the research, the studies, there's real scientific evidence in brain development that supports this, meaning that we know how the brain is forming. We know the chemicals that are released from the HPA axis. We know what toxic stress does. I mean, we can throw all these things out there that support this idea that mistakes can be made and they actually had an impact. And that removes the other stigma culturally, which is that if you are not feeling well, you have a disease and a disorder, and it was something you were born with. And I think that people are unwilling to admit their uncomfortableness that they have with their life because we have, without the benefit of understanding that, you know, attachment and parenting is the influencer in those, you know, those difficulties, and saying, well, I might actually have been born defective and I don't want anybody to know that I have a defect there. Which, you know, like I said, that's the second major stigma that we have to get through. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, hey folks, guess what? Actually, we're seeing that this is different, that, you know, because our parents, if we come to our parents, and this happened with, I think with many of us, hey, I'm not feeling well, they totally were detached from their influence and their effect on that behavior or their effect on that processing there. And some parents still do that. They see a problem child in front of them and they just want to know what's wrong with their kid. They haven't learned that they need to be more reflective with themselves, that there's something going on around this kid's environment that's actually 99.9% of the time causing that behavior issue, not that the kid was born with some sort of a defect in there.
No, that's right. No, I think that's really important. I think I speak to a lot of parents who talk about their children acting out. And like you said, it's talked about as a problem. How do I deal with my kids acting out? How do I deal with their bad behavior? We don't often see that this acting out and this quote unquote bad behavior is often the way that a child expresses a very, very deep need that they have, that they don't have the ability to verbalize or articulate. Often for a child, the way that their stress responses are expressed are through, you know, maybe biting, hitting, kicking, punching. Maybe they become the bully, or they somaticize their experiences. So they have a lot of physical symptoms like stomach aches and headaches, you know, these kind of weird, elusive symptoms that don't have an origin to point to. And it often is the case for a lot of parents that they think it's just there's something wrong with their kid, like you said. And I had this experience growing up where I was taken from doctor to doctor, and it was almost never the case that anyone looked to the home environment. I think it was never the case that someone looked to the home environment and said, what could be going on in this dynamic? Or, you know, when a child is acting out of their symptomatology or whatever it is, what they're really in need of is a strong and loving presence, a witness to be able to hold that experience and provide the child really the foundation that it's asking for in that moment. Mm-hmm. See me, hear me, help me, you know, help me deal with this, help me process this. And this is the problem that I think a lot of adults face when they're looking back. They have to come to see sometimes that, you know, often the threat that they experienced was from the people who were also charged to protect them, right? It was the same exact person that they both needed and needed to be attached to, and also in ways felt threatened around. And that is a difficult thing, I think, to come to terms with at first.
Yeah, I know. My therapist called it the struggle between understanding that your protector was also your perpetrator, you know, and having to balance that. So you're in Switzerland, but you have programs and services that you're able to, I mean, we're sitting here looking at each other, you know, so we know it's possible to do this. So let's talk about you, your practice and your show that you have.
Yeah, well, so I created the Bold as Love podcast, and basically it's a podcast that I started because I was really interested in being able to just talk more about the experiences of, you know, parents who are coming to terms with a lot of the early traumas that they might have had, and helping them maybe understand how to identify the effects of their early experiences, and really how they can be empowered or how they can recognize their own power to shape their own experience now. Really, it's really about taking responsibility. I really liked what you said about, or you were making a reference when we were talking about not looking to the home environment. I think often what happens is that this finding a diagnosis or finding some kind of label that we can attach to is often a way of not taking responsibility. And when I say responsibility in the sense that we can learn to understand and see the impact and the effect of the past on our present. And through our awareness of that, and through the ability that we have to cultivate more awareness of what's actually going on for us in our day-to-day experiences and in moments of stress and in moments of relationship, we have the power to influence how we shape the future. And that is so important because I think people feel often like they are trapped by genetics. They're trapped by the genetic hand they've been dealt, or just by the quote unquote personality that they were born with, right? And this idea of personality is something that we know now is highly influenceable. And so I'm really, I think, highly motivated to help people understand just how influenceable it is and also give people sort of the understanding, the tools to be able to start to explore those things and how they might do that. And also to understand how our children are impacted by us, you know? And this is, for me as a mother, a really important thing for me to be conscious and as I go forward in my own parenting. And I do so, I think, with this understanding fully on board that I am a human being, right? And I have been shaped by my past, but it does not have to be my sentence for the future, nor does it have to be the legacy that my children go forward into their lives with.
Right, right. And so for anybody listening, if you haven't figured it out, Corrine and I are definitely like speaking the same language and coming at the same thing from our two different perspectives. And so if you're looking for a show, you know, that complements One Broken Mom in terms of, you know, identifying, you know, your fierce motherhood and how to, you know, do better for yourself as well as your kids, then that's definitely a show to listen to. So, and it's called Bold as Love, right? And you can find it. Yeah,
the Bold as Love podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all those.
Right, cool. Can you describe what the somatic experience therapy session is like and how it might be different from someone who's maybe doing, let's call it traditional therapy with a cognitive behavioral therapist or somebody like that?
Sure. So I think in a SE session, you have a really wide variety of approaches that you can actually take in the session itself. But I think what's important to understand is that the talk aspect, the story aspect, the cognitive narrative, if you will, is not the thing that we're necessarily leading with or what we're working with. So a session, a typical session might look like maybe someone comes in, for example, after having a really stressful experience from the other, maybe like a week ago, they had a stressful experience. They come in and they might start to talk about that experience. And as they're starting to talk about it, they might start to get really activated, right? So their nervous system ramps up, the sympathetic nervous system starts going, they feel more energy. Now, the somatic experiencing practitioner might interrupt that and just have them notice that. One of the things that an SE session can do is help a person become consciously aware of what's happening at an implicit level in the body. So you're actually helping to make a connection between the implicit narrative or the somatic narrative and what's actually consciously, what we're consciously aware of in terms of what's happening in our bodies. Mm-hmm. So we might stop the person when they're telling the story and ask, can you notice that? Where do you notice that activation? Maybe they're pointing to an area of their body. They can explore that area. And one of the things we're also helping to facilitate is noticing how we call it tracking. So tracking changes in the sensations that we might experience throughout the body. So the sensations can move from different areas. What's really fascinating to me about the somatic experiencing approach as well is that, and this is something I've experienced in my own SE sessions, is that there's a level of trust that we can come to have in the story that's being told at the level of the implicit, often through sensations, through images. So, for example, an image might sort of flash in our mind. Now, in the SE session, we might be able to work with that image. I'll give you an example of this from my own experience, which was really interesting. I was in a session once. I was the client in the session, and I noticed I started the session out with my right arm felt like it was frozen. I mean, I just noticed it was like it was kind of hunched up. It was really tight. It was clenched. And as we were kind of, I was feeling into that arm, just noticing the sensations involved, I suddenly had the flash of an image of throwing a baseball. Now, normally in my everyday life, and I think for most of us, if an image like that popped up, we would think nothing of it. In fact, they're so subtle sometimes. They would just come up and they would just roll away as quickly as they came. But because I'm in SE, I know that images can tell us something. So I don't play baseball. I've never played baseball. I don't really even like baseball that much. So this image didn't necessarily mean anything. But of course, we decided to explore it. So in Etsy, what we do is we like to feel into the impulse that might arise to act in some way. So my arm wanted to throw a baseball. That was the image. That's what it felt like. And so I felt into that impulse, and then we might actually invite the arm to move in that way. We might invite the arm to actually throw the baseball. And I might do this a few times. And slowing down the impulse really allows us to get in touch with the action. It allows us to kind of bring that impulse into our conscious awareness, and also the energy or the emotion or related to that into our conscious awareness. So if I were just to do it really, really quick, I might miss the opportunity to really integrate it. Okay. So I did this really slowly. And what happened afterwards is that my arm just completely melted away. I didn't have to do anything else. This is actually a piece of work that we might do in an SE session. You may or may not work with explicit content, you know, and the idea is that a lot of the things that we might work with in an SE session are part of the implicit experience, meaning we don't have access to it consciously. And that's really the beauty of it, because you don't have to know the story. Or you don't have to know the reason why you might have symptoms, a symptom that is unexplainable, for example. You don't have to know exactly where it comes from in order to be able to work with it in an SE session.
That's good.
It's a very organic process, and it's an organic process that really can take you in a lot of different ways, to be honest. You kind of follow the body in that sense through the process, and you're trusting in this idea that innately, the organism knows how to heal itself given the time, the space, and the empathetic witness. Having that witness there to support and be a safe space is very, very profound. Like you said, it's like, you know, if I'm allowing trauma to come back into my awareness through this process, I'm looking to you as my practitioner to be able to hold that space in a way that tells me that I'm safe. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
Like the kid who goes to their parent and says, am I safe? Am I safe to feel this?
Yeah. I, you know, the immune system, it can be a pain in the ass, especially for those of us with an autoimmune disorder. But like, as you note, you know, when we sit there and think about how our body will automatically heal, you'll cut yourself on your hand and then it will go to work, and you don't have to tell the body to do that. It just does it on its own. And so what you're describing with this process is that we can even do it. And I guess I don't want people to latch on to that. This isn't the woo-woo positive thinking, you know, stuff that changes it. This is a connecting the body to the neuropathways process here, not just, you know, chanting good thoughts every morning or anything like that. And so, because I don't want people to dismiss this as a real way of healing themselves, mm-hmm. as just more of that, you know, stuff that you do see that is a little bit, you know, not as well, I don't want to say well-grounded. There are a lot of people that really do attract themselves to what makes them feel good and what helps them in there and stuff. And so, I'm not dismissing or judging anybody's approach to healing. But this is a science-based blended with, you know, your physical responses, which is also, I guess it's still science. Right?
It's true. I mean, a lot of SE comes from animal studies, actually. Really, studies of animal stress physiology. And we're learning again, actually, that we can be in touch with our own stress physiology. And through that awareness of our nervous system and how our nervous system works and the activation and deactivation cycles that it goes into and out of, we can learn to touch into it and get in touch with those thwarted or suppressed stress responses that we had as children, but that we couldn't express. And we can allow them, and we're basically moving then from places of stuckness and fixity into flow again when we can allow them their expression. We can allow them to emerge again and complete this cycle that they wanted to complete but weren't able to.
Yeah, that's a great explanation there. So thank you for letting me go back to and adding that question point in there. Corinne, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be able to have this conversation with me. Let everybody know, what's your website and how can they find you?
They can find me at KareenBell.com. That's where they can find me, and also the podcast on iTunes.
Yeah, awesome. So again, Karene Bell, The Somatic Experience, thank you so much for your time and for what you're doing for other people. So I'm hoping some folks actually meander over to your show and give it a listen. And I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much, Ami. I really appreciate it. And keep up the work you're doing too, because it's really important.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquercone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.